Good evening and welcome again. I'm Jack Hoppe. Glad to be back with WWNO's weekly New Orleans and Southeast Louisiana news magazine. Let's start. In her recent interview with Dave Davies on Fresh Air, the Times-Picayune's investigative reporter Cindy Chang explained that Louisiana is the prison capital of the world, with more imprisoned people per capita than any other state in the nation. Chang argues, however, that this high prison population is no accident. An approach which began as an effort to cope with prison overcrowding has led to a system in which local sheriffs receive financial incentives to keep prisoners out of state prisons and in their local for-profit facilities. In her interview, Chang elaborates on how this system results in harsh sentences and little educational opportunity for inmates, and how both private prison operators and the Louisiana Sheriff's Association lobby the legislature to keep prisoners in these exploited conditions.
Now, the conditions in the local jails run by these sheriffs, where they have this incentive to keep them full for their own budgets, how do those conditions differ from the big state institutions?
The term that's often used is warehousing. And if you ever visit one of these places, I think it's an apt term. And I called pretty much every sheriff who has this type of industry going. A lot of them didn't respond. These prisons are not like what you think of with cells and maybe one or two people per cell. They're usually dormitories and typically about 80 men or women, whatever the case may be, sleeping in a large room in bunk beds. And the difference is that in the sheriff's prison, you go in there and people are just lounging around that dorm. They're lying in bed in the middle of the day or watching soap operas. They will literally sit there day after day, year after year, until their sentence is over. While in a state prison, which is where most states house almost all of their inmates, you're busy whether you like it or not. You have a job or you take classes or you're learning a trade like welding or plumbing that will help you get a job when you get out.
And the fundamental issue here is that a system has been set up, and this was done in the 1990s when there was an overcrowding problem. A system was set up in which local sheriffs were encouraged to build or get these prisons built on the notion that they could take care of them for a little under 25 bucks a day. And it seems like as long as you do that, there simply isn't going to be the money to really rehabilitate people and give them skills. Is there?
Right. So now we've gotten this situation where we have the highest incarceration rate in the country. So we have lots of prisoners, but they're being housed real cheaply. So it's kind of a vicious cycle. How do you reduce... If you can reduce the prison population, then hopefully you'll have more money left over to give the ones who are in the system more help.
And the fact is that the financial incentives for local sheriffs is not to reduce the prison population, but to keep it high.
Absolutely. And the Sheriff's Association is one of the most powerful lobbies in the state, and they have consistently oppose any sort of change that would reduce the prison population. Although this year in the legislature, there was a slight shift. I think that the budget problems, as in other states, have gotten so bad that there is pressure on the sheriffs and the district attorneys, who also traditionally oppose these things, to at least stand down on some of these cost-saving measures.
One of the interesting things about this is that, you know, I think Louisiana has for years had a reputation of a state with a lot of corruption, particularly rural corruption. But what's interesting about the system as you describe it is that it came out of a problem in the 1990s where there was overcrowding. And it was the kind of solution which at the time, you know, a lot of political scientists were embracing, you know, reinventing government, thinking outside the box, creating a different set of incentives, embracing the innovation of private enterprise. And they've set up something which just has a lot of perverse effects.
Right. I think at the time, it may have seemed like a reasonable ad hoc solution. You didn't have money to build another state prison. And you're sitting there as the head of the Department of Corrections, you can't make the legislature reduce sentences or devise alternative programs to reduce the population. I mean, the prisoners just keep coming into the system, so what are you going to do? And Richard Stalder, who was the head of the Department of Corrections at the time, he actually is a trained economist. So he very consciously said, well, what can I do to get the sheriffs to want to house these inmates instead of complaining about it? And, of course, the solution was money.
How do criminal sentences in Louisiana compare with other states?
They're pretty harsh. In Louisiana, right now, all life sentences are without parole. Louisiana leads the country in the percentage of its inmates who are serving life without parole. That means that you never get a chance to go before a parole board and say, hey, I've changed. Give me another chance. So at Angola, which is where most of these people go, they have so many older inmates who are really on their deathbed, who are costing the state so much money, but there's no mechanism, or there's very few mechanisms to release them. And on the lower end, too, sentences are pretty harsh. For example, recently in St. Tammany Parish, which is a suburb of New Orleans, there was a guy who got 24 years without parole for a car burglary. It was his actually third offense, although he was prosecuted as a second offender. But we have pretty strict habitual offender laws here as well.
You can get a 10 or 20 years for writing bad checks?
And people regularly do. I mean, yeah, they'll get 5 or 10 years for something like that. And it's usually not their first offense, but you rarely see something like that in another state.
So what does the sentencing system do in terms of the mix of violent and nonviolent offenders in these county jails?
Well, Louisiana has a much higher percentage of nonviolent offenders in its prison population than the national average. And we have plenty of violent crime in this state. New Orleans leads the nation in murders. So that implies that our sentencing structure is putting more nonviolent, particularly drug offenders, in the system. And those are the very offenders that tend to end up in the for-profit sheriff's prisons.
Now, there's clearly a public appetite for harsh sentences. I mean, people are angry about crime. But you also have people, prison operators and local sheriffs, who seem to have a financial incentive for keeping the prison population high. Is there any evidence that either the prison operators or the sheriffs themselves play a role in keeping sentences harsh?
Sure. I mean, on the level of political donations, the two big private prison companies, which are LaSalle and LCS, are pretty big donors to sheriffs, to the governor, to state legislators. And as I mentioned before, the Louisiana Sheriff's Association, as well as the District Attorney's Association, are very powerful lobbies.
Did you talk to any sheriffs who look at the system and say, this isn't exactly what we ought to be doing?
I think a lot of them are conscious of some of the moral issues that are raised. And we spent a lot of time in Richland Parish in northeast Louisiana, and the sheriff there, he will tell anybody who asks him about the prison, we hate to make money off of the backs of unfortunate people. But the fact is, it's been good for the parish.
Well, Cindy Chang, I hope you do get to continue this kind of work, and I want to thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Bringing up big rocks on a chain gang. Bringing rocks and serving my time. Bringing rocks out here on a chain gang. 'Cause I've been convicted of crime.
Here on All Things New Orleans, Cindy Chang spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. She is a special projects writer for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, and you'll find links to the paper's series, Louisiana Incarcerated, on Fresh Air's website, freshair.npr.org.
Oh, well, and I still got so terribly long to go on.
This is 89.9 WWNO and All Things New Orleans. I'm Jack Hopke. I want to remind you, before we go any further, that we archive all our pieces, all our features, all the entries on this program at our website, WWNO.org. Check them out anytime. Next, 60 years ago, if you'd asked a New Orleanian about or, say, for directions to 1026 Conti Street, you would have elicited a far different reaction than you would today. On this week's Notes from New Orleans, Sharon Litwin brings us the story of a renowned and renovated bordello.
One of the reasons New Orleans has been able to hang on to so many wonderful historic properties is the passion of those, native or newcomer, who buy and restore old buildings. Bob O'Brien is one of them. Imagine his surprise to learn that his most recent renovation had a very different history. It had been, he discovered, a house of prostitution. And not just any old house of ill repute, but one owned by Norma Wallace, the famed Last Madam of New Orleans.
There was a play going on in the city called The Last Madam by Chris Wilkes. And I went by and looked at a picture of the property that she had in display for the play. And, of course, I bought the book and trying to relate the description that she used in the book for different parts of the building, it all began to get clear. So at that point, I contacted Chris, and she and I kind of got together and confirmed what she had written, because she was in the property before I bought it, when it was actually occupied.
Now, in any other city, the knowledge that one had bought a bordello might best be kept secret. But not in New Orleans. Instead, Bob researched everything he could about 1026 Conti Street and the madam who ran a lavish and politically protected business there until the mid-1960s. Norma Wallace, folks said, stashed her cash in a secret money drop in a wall and had equally secret places where her ladies of the night and their visitors could be hidden if there was a police raid. Bob had heard there was a hidden side gate where she could pay off certain police and where celebrities and college boys, gangsters and governors could all come to visit without being seen. He was intrigued.
I began to explore some of the walls and tapping on the walls, trying to find hidden pockets. And we did discover where the hideout was, where the Johns and the girls were hid during raids. We also found the money hole where Norma would drop her paperwork and money into this hole, which is still there. And we found the side gate where she would make payoffs to the policemen and also check credentials of the college kids that would come wanting to use the brothel.
For a mid-city boy who graduated Warren Easton High School, Bob couldn't believe he'd never heard about Norma Wallace and 1026 Conti Street.
I was just amazed that I didn't know of the house. I belonged to the New Orleans Athletic Club, which is right down the street, and a friend of mine stopped me, and he said, "You bought Norma Wallace's house, huh?" I said, "Yeah," and he said, "Man," he said, "a lot of people from the NOAC used to go there," and he said, "In fact, they used to call it the NOAC Annex."
But that's not all Bob learned. Just as fascinating was how Norma Wallace, ever discreet, managed to show, for want of a better description, her gratitude to certain obliging men in blue.
The interesting thing about the side door is that the alley that goes alongside of the property does not belong to anyone. It belongs to the city. So the policeman could actually get his payoff by walking his beat, and it was down this driveway alley. So they didn't have to come into the property for their payoff.
Now Bob O'Brien has converted 1026 Conti into a series of upscale apartments, all rented to folk who, enthusiastically, he says, embrace the building's racy history. And he's had so many requests to open the building that he's going to do that one time on Sunday, June 24th. It's part of a new weekend getaway for women called Festigals, a three-day event that includes a luncheon with Hoda Kotb as guest speaker, French Quarter tours, fabulous restaurant meals, and other experiences, both divine and decadent.
There's going to be a saints and sinner That's Sunday, and they're going to the gospel service in the Treme area. That's the Saints part. And after that, they're going to go tour 1026 Conti, and that's going to be the center part. And we're going to take them through. Chris Waltz is going to be there with a book and talking about Norma and Norma's life. And I'll be there going through the renovation process and some of the before and after pictures to give them a flavor of what it takes to pull that project together.
To learn more about Norma Wallace and how she ran 1026 Conti, as well as the Festigals event, go to wwno.org or nolavie.com. For WWNO, I'm Sharon Lee.
Sharon Litwin is the co-founder of NolaVie.com and a regular contributor to WWNO's local programming, which includes all things New Orleans, the June 7th edition. Hi again, Jack Hopke here. Now, this coming weekend, the 26th annual French Market Creole Tomato Festival and the 6th annual Jazz and Heritage Foundation Louisiana Cajun Zydeco Festival will take place in the French Quarter. Diane Mack brings us details about our distinctive red fruit and the equally distinctive dance music of Southwest Louisiana.
Somebody's going to grab you and spin you around on the dance floor. That's how we pass a good time, Shaq.
Jazz and Heritage Foundation spokesman and event coordinator Scott Aegis knows how irresistible that two-step and dance music from Southwest Louisiana can be.
On Saturday nights, folks would gather in people's houses, and they would move the furniture out of the way. They would tell the kids to go to bed, or in French, faire dormir, or fait dodo, where that phrase comes from. And they would all get to drinking and hooting and hollering and pick up the fiddles and the accordions and the washboards and start to develop this style of music that has clear references from Canadian music, French music, European, Scottish reels, those types of things, waltzes. And it was infused with this propulsive rhythm that comes from Caribbean and Afro-Caribbean roots. And together, they formed this really awesome dance style that we know today as Cajun and Zydeco, which are really two branches of the same tree.
And he says this year's Louisiana Cajun Zydeco Festival will debut a host of musical headliners.
C.J. Chenier this year was nominated for a Grammy Award. He is the son of Clifton Chenier, who, as I'm sure you know, was one of the original pioneers of Zydeco music. He and his band are making their debut at our festival. Also, another Zydeco artist who we've never had before is Gino Delafosse and his band French Rock and Boogie. And like C.J. Chenier, he's known all over the world as one of the great ambassadors of Louisiana dance music. Another person who we haven't had the pleasure of having before is D.L. Menard, the legendary 80-year-old Cajun musician who plays in one of the most authentic, original, traditional Cajun styles. He's also an artisan who makes his own accordions. We also have some favorites who are coming back. Lost Bayou Ramblers, Les Frères Michaud, who are very, very traditional Cajun band, Nathan Williams and the Zydeco Cha-Chas. They're a very, very popular Zydeco band. Nathan has a son, also named Nathan, and Little Nathan and the Zydeco Big Timers will also be at our festival. We've got a woman named Mary Broussard, who has her own Zydeco band, Creole Royalty. She has a son named Brian, who has his own Zydeco band. And they will be on stage, actually, in back-to-back sets.
Aegis says you'll find several groups on two stages of music, a crafts fair, and food in and around the area of the old U.S. Mint.
The Esplanade stage is big, open air, with the shade from the oak trees on Esplanade. The Barrack Street stage will be a large, open air stage, and we're also expanding our use of misting fans this year, so we're doubling the number of misting fans as we've had in the past, and we're also adding a misting tent.
Now, just across the way at the French Market, the 26th annual Creole Tomato Festival celebrates the arrival of this year's Red Beauties, with another stage of music and a host of activities, including cooking demonstrations, tomato samples, and a tomato eating contest. the 26th Annual French Market Creole Tomato Festival, and the Jazz and Heritage Foundation's 2012 Louisiana Cajun Zydeco Festival run Saturday and Sunday in the French Quarter. More information can be found at CajunZydecoFest.com and FrenchMarket.org. Inside the Arts for 89.9 WWNO, I'm Diane Mack.
Additional music stages for the festival will be Dutch Alley, as well as at the Jazz Park Indoors Visitor Center. Well, it would be nice to let that run right up to fresh air. It's so intoxicating. But we have a few things to say to you as we wrap this week's ATNO. Actually, we remind you that all our features are archived at our website, wwno.org. Listen and share anytime. I'm Jack Hopke. All Things New Orleans is produced by myself and Thomas Walsh, who sincerely hope to have encouraged you with tonight's pieces to avoid prison and houses of ill repute, but to have encouraged you wholeheartedly to indulge in a sweaty dance or two and several juicy Creole pommes d'amour. We will see you next week.